Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. When Ajahn Chah would give us teachings and encourage us, he put a lot of emphasis on reflection, investigation, that ability of the mind to consider carefully our experience. And this is, of course, a quality that the Buddha himself relies on and encourages as well. Yesterday in the Q&A, there was a question around stream enterer. And I gave a quote of the sutta that points to the factors of stream entry, two being external, having association with wise beings, and two, hearing Dhamma. Two were internal qualities, first being Yoniso Manisikara, which is translated in many ways, wise reflection, is a general one. Attending appropriately is how Ajahn Jeff tends to translate it. And Dhamma Nu Dhamma Patibhata, an internal practice in the sense of practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And I thought I would maybe illustrate the how the Buddha kind of expected or encouraged us to reflect. Actually, with the say that yoniso manisikara, that wise reflection, is something that the Buddha introduces in many, many circumstances, and there are many appropriate themes for, say, for wise reflection. But the important quality is that one is reflecting, investigating, attending. The word manasikara is attention. So it's not so much thinking a lot about something, but attending, placing the mind on something, seeing it clearly, and then being able to turn it over in one's mind so that one has a deeper grasp of what one is attending to. But the Buddha points out, he says that in the same way that when one sees the sky turning in the morning, the light in the sky turning in the morning, one knows that a new day is coming upon one. He said, in the same way, when one recognizes yoniso manasikara in one's own mind, one can start to say recognize or have confidence that the Noble Eightfold Path would arise within one, that one is, one's practice is starting to come together. I'll pick out one particular discourse that the Buddha uses to illustrate yoniso manasikara, and I think particularly in terms of the aspect of around that question of stream entry. You know, what do I do in order to direct my efforts towards entering the Dhamma fully. And the sutta is one that protagonists are Sariputta and Mahagodhita, who are two friends who, there's actually many discourses where they're having a Dhamma discussion between them, and it's usually Mahagodhita kind of prodding Sariputta with questions and picking his brain, so to speak, so that Mahagodhita asks Sariputta, what is it that a virtuous person, in this case, virtuous monk, what is it that a virtuous person should attend to appropriately, or in the sense, yoniso manasikara, have wise reflection around. And Sariputta answers that one should attend appropriately or to reflect wisely on the nature of the form aggregate, in particular, the aggregate of the clinging aggregate, in that the aggregate of form of the body that is subject to clinging or upadana, and to reflect on it as something that is in constant changing. A cancer, a disease, an emptiness, a non-self. And sort of, it's actually a whole long list of more things that he says in sort of looking on it in its problematic nature, and in the sense of its impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self nature. And I said, if one, and then to look on the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the mental formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate. And these are the five aggregates, five khandhas, the basis of a being. And Sariputta said, if one looks on these as in constant, impermanent, changing, a disease, a cancer, an emptiness, a non-self, then one could be free from those, released from those, and realize the fruit of stream entry. And then he goes through, and then Mahagodhita then sort of asks, well, what does a stream enterer reflect wisely on? And then Sariputta sort of said, well, the stream enterer would reflect on form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, as in constant changing, as in exactly the same way. And if one reflected wisely in that way, then it's quite likely that one would become a once returner, which is the next stage of liberation, of freedom. And then, of course, Mahagodhita is never satisfied, and gives another question of, well, what does a once returner do? And of course, Sariputta goes through the same thing. And if they did it in that way, they would possible that they would become a non-returner. What does a non-returner do? Exactly the same thing. It's possible they could become an arhat. And then Mahagodhita, in true to fashion, says, well, what does an arhat do? Sariputta goes through it exactly the same way, that they reflect on the clinging aggregate of form, clinging aggregate of feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness in exactly the same way. He goes through it sort of word for word. But then he ends up saying, not because there is anything else for an arahant to do or that there's anything to add to what an arahant has done, but for it leads to a pleasant abiding here and now and leads to mindfulness and alertness, so that the even for an arahant, it's a source of well-being, reflecting wisely, attending appropriately on experience. So that the directing of attention toward these five aggregates of being is really a key factor for being able to pull oneself out of the, say, the stream of the world and into the stream of Dhamma, and to be able to direct our attention in this way. Of course, that's reflect on the say this morning we chanted the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which is the Buddha setting in rolling the wheel of Dhamma, and when and in that discourse the Kandanya was Anya Kandanya realized stream entry, and in the story of this is in the text of the Discipline of Vinaya, and it tells the story of after Kundanya's realization, then the Buddha spent time teaching the others, instructing them. Sometimes two or three of them would go off on alms round, and the others would stay back to receive instruction from the Buddha, and then kind of one by one, each of these, of the five ascetics that lived and trained with the Buddha, all realized stream entry. And it doesn't actually specify the amount of time, whether it was days or weeks, or it certainly wasn't months, it was probably days or weeks. And when all five of them were stream enterers, that was when the Buddha gave his instruction on the discourse on not self, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and it's in the chanting book, and it's the Buddha taking those five aggregates of being and all of the things that we assume a sense of self, a sense of I, of me, of mine. And what the one of the descriptions is sort of the I making, the mind making, the underlying tendency to conceit, so that the mind conceives of and clings to the identity of a being, of me, of mine, around these natural functions, and just the sense of the physical body, having a physical body, it's a natural function, but we take it to be, you know, who we are. We take it and we assume a sense of selfhood. as an interesting way that a Thai teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa, describes it in that he said, as us as human beings, as sort of ordinary, run-of-the-mill, uninstructed human beings, unenlightened, we act like thieves, and we get punished like thieves, in that we steal things out of nature, and that sense where the stealing or the thieving of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. They're not ours. They belong to nature. They're not what, they don't belong to us. We don't have any real right of possession. But we take them. We misappropriate them and assume a sense of I, me, and mine, of selfhood around them. And then we wonder why we suffer. So that it's just, well, that's what happens when you're a thief. You get into trouble. So that if something, you know, it's not a way that we usually think or view experience. Now, the assumption is always an assumption of selfhood. So that this sense of the Buddha pointing to that basis of experience getting us to look at it in a different way, getting us to look at it in terms of Dhamma as opposed to our own assumptions, projections, preference, hope, just really coming back, oh, this is the way nature is. And when we think of Dhamma, this is a truth of nature. This is what the truth of nature is. Say we're born, we have a body that grows and develops and matures and gets older, we don't have a whole lot of say in it. It follows its nature. Feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, they come and go. Perceptions, memory, the ways that we make meaning out of the world through the perceptual process. This is all conditioned. It might be somewhat unique to us, but it's conditioned and it's unstable, not to be relied on, and therefore, say, not worthy of taking as a self. Same with the mental formations. Our thoughts, our ideas. It's not as if we try to annihilate them or that if we didn't have them, then we'd be better off. It's just that we assume something more of them than they actually are. And when we make that assumption, we create problems for ourselves. We end up in a place of discontent and dissatisfaction. So that viewing things in their true nature, viewing things in their, this is where that sense of looking at it through the lens of that which leads to a cooling and disenchantment rather than something that stirs up clinging and and attachment. And that's the key. It's not that Buddha is making an absolute statement, but he's giving us the tools to be able to free ourselves. And that's when that other aspect of the factors of stream entry, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. There's a discourse where the Buddha, when he asks a rhetorical question, you know, what is practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma? And then, of course, he goes ahead and answers his own question. And he lifts up that theme of the five khandhas, these five aggregates of being. Practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, one practices in a way that one reflects for the arising of disenchantment towards form, practicing for the disenchantment toward feeling, disenchantment toward perception, disenchantment towards mental formations, disenchantment towards consciousness, toward these five khandhas, these five aggregates of being. And then the Buddha goes on to say, and when one practices in a way that, say, facilitates the arising of disenchantment toward form, feeling, perception, mental formation, consciousness, one comprehends form, feeling, and one comprehends form, comprehends feeling, comprehends perception, comprehends mental formations, comprehends consciousness. So that this sense that the practicing and turning attention toward that which is for the arising of disenchantment is giving us the opportunity to be able to comprehend, to understand fully. Because when we approach our experience through the lens of our assumptions or our views and opinions, our preferences, then we don't really comprehend it fully. We don't understand it fully. We don't see through it. And that's what, say, the word vipassana means, to see through, to be able to see through the things that we cling on to, see through the things that we attach to, see through the things that we make assumptions from. So being able to comprehend, to understand fully these basic aggregates of being, body and mind, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. Then the Buddha goes on to say, and when one practices in a way which leads to, when one comprehends form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, then one is released from form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. The act of understanding fully, of comprehending, seeing through these aspects of being, in itself is the trigger, is the key that allows us to be released from, to be emancipated from, to be free from the habits. And that's what it is, the habits of being that keep returning us to a place of discontent or confusion, dissatisfaction. And that's when the Buddha says, and when it was released from form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, one is released from sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, all the different forms of suffering and stress. And so that sense of practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma, this is the Buddha gives a very clear guideline and a way to, if certainly the one of the ways that one wouldn't describe the Buddha as being a woolly thinker, and is just very precise, is very clear. This is the way through, and this is the way to freedom. And so that is giving these tools for us to be able to understand clearly. So that these aspects of say our practice, say the tools of practice, are just this body and mind, just the things that we have that are the basis of our experience. When they're not understood, they lead to suffering, to difficulty. When they are understood, then they lead to freedom, to wisdom, to bringing, think of the bringing blessings to oneself and to the world. But it does take this investigation, wise reflection, and then putting it into practice, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And that sense of that cultivation of a disenchantment, one realizes there's a compelling compelling story, a compelling feeling toward these aggregates of being. What the Buddha did was incredibly radical, on a certain level, it really goes against all of our how we would normally view our experience. But to be able to pick up that theme and to reflect on it, and being able to break that enchantment. It's sort of breaking the spell. It's like a fairy tale when the spell is broken, all of a sudden everything falls into place. When the spell is cast on the on the prince or the princess, and then there's all these difficulties and problems, but when that spell is broken, when that enchantment has been kind of cast out, then they live happily ever after. So that sense of viewing things, reflecting on things in a way that helps to foster a quality of disenchantment. The word in Pali is nibbida, and disenchantment, I think, is a really good word to describe that, just because of that sense, an enchantment, a spell. Bhikkhu Bodhi has been, for some time now, has been translating nibbida as disgust, and sort of having disgust toward the body, having disgust toward feeling, disgust toward perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And it's a very strong word, and tends to come across as not only negative but even aversive. But I think one of the ways of looking at it is looking at it in terms of the roots of the word of disgust, in the sense that the roots of the word really mean, it's like losing the flavor. One loses the flavor, losing the taste. It's no longer tasty. It's no longer flavorful. And that's really what it is when, you know, it's and when one has a particular addiction to food, some particular food that one really, really likes, and then you can't eat it anymore. It just makes you sick. It's like an extreme case would be like for in Thailand, you have durian addictions. You know, for people who've smelt durian, you think, God, this stuff is horrible. And you can't take it on planes. It's not allowed to be on planes or in public areas because it's considered to be, it smells so bad. But it's really addictive. And people will pay huge amounts of money to get the first crop from special places. But then you sort of think, when one said loses the taste for it, loses the flavor for it. I really liked durian when I lived in Thailand. I really liked it. It's very heating. So, and at some point it was too heating for me. I couldn't eat it anymore. Yeah. So there. So one loses the flavor, loses the taste. So in the same way, one directs attention toward the body, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. It isn't as if it's such a, you know, so for one who's not enthralled by it, it's sort of like, one looks at these five aggregates of being as if it's like durian. Most people say, "Oh, God, grief! How could people be addicted to it?" But we tend not to think in that way, according to these aggregates of being. So the Buddha has us contemplate. And there's another discourse where the Buddha speaks of he compares them to different things that are, comparing the body to foam on that's floating down a river, what do you think? Do you think that foam is something that is substantial or insubstantial? It's insubstantial. In the same way, the body is insubstantial. There's an empty quality to it. Buddha compares feeling to, it's just like in the rainy season when the rain comes down and big heavy drops, and it forms bubbles on the surface of water, and these bubbles form. And so feelings are like bubbles. They just the rain comes down, the bubble forms, and then they pop. Or you want to say like a soap bubble, where you get kids where you put the little ring in and put it into soap, and you blow it, and the bubbles go out, and then they last for a, a, longer or shorter amount of time, but they don't last for all that long, and then they pop. And the same with pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling. They're feelings that are like bubbles that come into being and they pop. They're insubstantial. The perception, the Buddha compares it to like in the hot season, looking out and in the distance and seeing a mirage. And that it seems substantial in the distance, but when we get close to it, it disappears. And the same with, there's an insubstantiality to perception. It has that same quality as a mirage. It's not solid, it's not stable. But of course, we actually run our lives around perceptions, the way we perceive things, the value and meaning that we place on things. Perception is both both memory and then the value and meaning that we place on things. We experience something, we immediately place a certain value on it or an assumption around it. Perception works very quickly. And then we go towards or pull away from certain experiences or people or circumstances because of the way that we perceive, so that those perceptions we look and investigate and say, wow, they're actually insubstantial there. It's like oftentimes when you first meet somebody, you'll form a perception of whether you like them or you don't like them, whether they're a good person or not a good person, and we fill a whole story in about these people, and we don't even haven't even talked to them yet, that's the way perception works. So that and oftentimes if we're careful or honest, and you give people a break and get to know them a bit, but sometimes we act on those perceptions, and we don't really know how valid they are at all. So reflecting on their insubstantiality. Mental formations, the Buddha compares it to somebody going out into the forest seeking a tree, a tree with some heartwood, a good solid tree, a good teak tree, or something you could build with, so with some heartwood, and then settling on a banana tree, which is the way the banana tree is formed. They're just layers and layers and layers of kind of leaf structure, so that there's no central core to them. Even though they can grow to be quite large and grow quite tall, but there's no central core to them, so that there's this insubstantial nature. So the same with our thoughts. There's these layers and layers of our mental formations, thoughts, ideas, views, the different ways that we consider and proliferate. It's so essential to be able to peel those layers of thought back and see, well, what's underneath there? What is there? And you say, wow, this is really insubstantial. So that viewing it as a banana tree, and consciousness. So the Buddha compares it to in the marketplace and there being a sort of a magician performing a magic trick, and of course a good magician is able to use sleight of hand, use body movement, to be able to distract your attention. And make it all seem like something else. And consciousness is doing that all the time. We're not really getting a good insight into our experience until we start questioning and investigating with disenchantment that functioning of consciousness. So these five aggregates of being form the basis of all of our experience, who we are, what we are, what we experience. But they need to be investigated and understood, not need to be comprehended, so that we can be released from them. That the relinquishment that comes through seeing things in their true nature. And it doesn't mean that we end up with nothing. What we end up with is a body and mind that is well grounded in the true nature of things. Somebody like the Buddha or his noble disciples, these are beings one wants to draw close to, one wants to emulate. And if I think in terms of my own experience of human beings, certainly, say, Ajahn Chah was the kind of the most sane, normal human being that I ever met. Kind of awesomely competent. really able to use experience in a way that benefits himself, benefited so many others. So that when we reflecting on these five aggregates and viewing them in a way that helps us to loosen our grip, release some of our assumptions and clinging and attachment. Another image that the Buddha uses is of sort of like a mountain stream that where the current is really swift and it's carrying everything along with it. And if somebody fell into that current, then into that stream, of course they'd try to get out and they'd grasp at the grasses and twigs and any little branches that they could get hold of from the along the shore. But the current is so swift that it would pull them away and leave them, without safety, without refuge. And then the Buddha, it is in the same way, we've fallen into this stream of samsara. We've fallen into this stream of dependence on our attachments and delusions, and we grasp after the form, feeling, perception. It's just like the grasses, the twigs, the branches. We grasp at that, and they're not able to provide a refuge. They're not able to provide a sense of real safety. The seeing through, the comprehending, the understanding, relinquishment, that's what really leads to clarity and to peace. That's what really leads to having Dhamma as a refuge and entering the stream of Dhamma. And that, of course, that's a noble aspiration and a something really worthy of putting our effort and attention towards. So as we meditate and contemplate, and we're using the breath as our object of meditation, we're using the walking meditation, it's not just a concentration exercise, but one's directing attention towards a settling of the mind, but then one's also seeding the mind with certain perspectives that help one to see things in their true nature. And if the mind starts to get spinning out with thinking about these things too much, then you have to just come back to the breath and settle. As I said, it's not just a matter of if we keep pushing the mind onto the breath and we keep focusing the mind in concentration, then something magical is going to happen. We need to wisely consider our experience. We need to reflect in accordance with Dhamma, to offer that reflection today.